Well, thank you for that very nice introduction, and thank you all for coming tonight out of your busy schedules. I'm thrilled. I'm thrilled to be here. I'm really honored to be in this lecture series, and it's great that we could be honoring Math Awareness Month this way. So I'm going to give you a strange whirlwind and personal view of data mining tonight. Data mining, fool's gold or the mother lode? That's the question I want to answer tonight. Little ad for where I come from. It's you guys are into summer here already. It's amazing. We're not quite there yet. That'll be briefly around the 4th of July, and then winter hits. But it's lovely for that weekend, and it's you can already see the leaves turning. That's probably July 5th. Okay. So first of all, so I'm going to talk about data mining. So the first question I have is, well, what is data mining? And for that, I went to the source of all knowledge. I typed data mining into Google and hit return. And what did I get? I got several definitions. And I'm not going to read them, but they all have to do with finding hidden patterns in lots of data. So novel ideas, potentially useful, understandable patterns. And another one's finding interesting structures. A knowledge discovery process, we'll talk about that means of extracting previously unknown information from very large databases. And my favorite one, by a man named Edelstein, who is over there, who I didn't know was coming, but there we go. The process that uses a variety of data analysis tools to discover patterns and relationships in data that may be used to make valid predictions. Well, Herb and I worked together for a while. Maybe that's why I like this definition so much. All right, anyway, so what are you getting a sense out of this is that it's making models and making predictions out of big databases. So, but what is it really? And for that, I turn to the other source of all information, Dilbert. So here's the CEO saying, we have a gigantic database full of customer behavior information. Dilbert says, excellent. We can use nonlinear math and data mining technology to optimize our retail channels. Any CEOs here? And we can speak freely. So the CEO hasn't understand so any of this. He says, well, if that's the same thing as spam, we're having a good meeting here. This is a scary thought. This is usually how it is. I often get the phone call when the CEO has probably been in that front section of the plane and looked at the magazine, and in there is said something about business and something about Walmart doing something, and he's reading along and says, data mining, we better do this. So 20 years ago, it might have been Taguchi methods, and then it was Kaizen, and then it was just in time, and now it's data mining. So we got to be doing whatever this is, we've got to do it. In fact, any of you know about Six Sigma? Hear about Six Sigma? Okay, well, Six Sigma was, it still is important, but it really had a heyday a little while ago. And we had at the ASA, we invited a CEO to come talk to us about his experiences with Six Sigma. And we were asking him, he said, oh, this has really changed our lives. I mean, it's made such an impact on that company. They said, well, could you be a little more specific? He says, well, you know, I don't know all the technical details. He said, but one thing for sure is the more Sigma, the better. So, you know, we're at 6 this year, but I think we'll be at 7 or 8 by next year, you know. So this is why I get the phone calls, typically, is that somebody has said, we got to be doing this, and then somebody at the next level tries to do it, and what they want is to buy some software. It's not cheap software either. And they want to buy it and push F6 and have knowledge start spewing out immediately. And it often doesn't happen. And then we get the phone call. So that's what we're going to talk about. So it sounds, is this just statistics on big data? Well, Jerry Friedman, who's a famous statistician, was asked this once at a conference. I was discussing a paper, and he was there. We were in a panel. And somebody said, well, is this just statistics? And he said, do you want the short answer or the long answer? They said, the short answer. He said, yeah. The long answer is interesting, but maybe we'll get to some of it. So I was recently at an NSF-sponsored conference in India on big data. And I thought, I did big data. I mean, I feel like I've done some big data things. Well, in the middle of it, I was supposed to talk on the challenges of big data. In the middle of the conference, after listening to 2 talks, I changed my slides quickly, and I crossed that big, and I said, well, medium size, because there were 2 groups that really just blew me out of the water in terms of data size. And one was the people in Switzerland looking for the Higgs boson. I mean, you know, petabytes an hour is a lot of data. And the other one was the gravitational wave people who are also looking at something. And that's, so they had argument about whether it was petabytes per hour or day. You know, but and in the middle of listening to these guys go on and on, I get paid the big bucks to ask really dumb questions. So I said, let me just get this straight. Both of you guys have petabytes per hour or day, which is orders of magnitude more data than I've ever seen. But neither of you has actually seen what you're looking for yet. And one guy got really upset. He said, no. He said, that's not really it. And the other guy said, well, yeah, it is sort of it. And he said, and the gravitational wave guy is my favorite comment. I'm going to use this somehow. He said, no, we've definitely seen it. He said, we just can't distinguish it from the noise yet. And I said, well, no wonder my students have trouble with this concept. So, yeah. Right, but they've seen it. Okay. All right, so a little history on where it started. So I'm going to give my own very personal view of where it started. Well, I think this isn't the personal part. I think that it's pretty well agreed that a lot of the first problems in data mining came from the business world and came from customer relationship management. Big credit card banks were starting to collect data in the 80s. And they had this huge data set where they've been collecting transactional data on your charges. And they thought, wow, maybe there's something else we could do with this. And in fact, I was lucky enough to be in a chief technical officer's office, which this isn't it, but it was something like this. It was as imposing as this in Delaware. It was First USA Bank. And we were standing there in Rick's office, Rick Scully, and Rick had some brilliant ideas. I mean, he had this great idea to steal everybody else's customers. First USA was a tiny little company in 1984 or so. It had just a few thousand customers. But Bank of America had millions of customers. So how do you get them? He invented a concept called balance transfer. You may remember. It said, we'll give you a toaster. Literally, it was a toaster. We'll give you a toaster and we'll lower your annual percentage point rate by 2 points if you just give us your balance. And people said, well, why not? I get a toaster and it's lower. So suddenly they had millions of customers. So Rick thought he was pretty smart, and I think he was. And he said to me one day, what I want to do, he said, I want to look at the data that we have. He said, I want to look at all this transactional data. I want to look at the patterns in it. I want to anticipate people's needs before they know what they want. And I thought, wow, how are we going to do that? And he said, well, all the data are in the data warehouse, not a term that I knew. And I said, oh, was that room with all the big spinning disk drives and stuff? It was IBM's at the time, guys in white coats in an air-conditioned room in the middle of the building. He said, no, we're not quite there yet. And I said, we're not there yet? So where are we? And he said, that's why I'm doing this. He said, we see that building down there near the stadium they're building? And I said, yeah. He said, that's the data warehouse. I said, what do you mean? He said, yeah, the data are sitting in boxes in there on that. Remember that printer paper that was about this wide? And you go like this? And I said, oh, no, we're not going to do that. I said, why don't we wait until you get it into the room down the hall with the air conditioning, and then we'll talk. Because there's no way I was going to find patterns in that. And that took a few years. That was one of the big challenges, is getting all that digitized. And as soon as that happened, of course, things started taking off. And he was just a little ahead of his time. Not a bad place to be. So that was really the beginnings. But where else is data mining used today? The answer is everywhere. So fraud detection, credit scoring, still lots of commercial applications like that. But also in science, rational drug design, lots of interest in, I'm at Williams College. We're the second oldest institution of higher education in the state of Massachusetts. There is an older one somewhere to our east. I forget the name, but in that institution there is a biostatistics department with probably 100 PhD statisticians who are looking at genomics data all the time. I mean, it's a huge industry of looking for what's going on with the patterns in genomics, what the roots of diseases are, what the relationships are. It's a huge business. This was just in the AMS notices, an article called What is Data Mining? This is a biomolecule and some data on it. It said they're doing data mining on it. That's really all I know about it, but I love the image, so I took it. Clinical trials. Now, this is not traditionally a place where you would expect data mining to happen. Clinical trials are carefully designed studies. Pharmaceutical companies have dozens, usually PhD statisticians, who do this full time. Why would I get involved with that? The little note here saying non-traditional uses. So what I get the patient after it's already dead. I do the autopsy. So I get the clinical trial after it's over, and they say, let's go back and look at that clinical trial and see, can we see instances of adverse experiences? Can we link that to something else? Not just testing whether the medication worked, but what else was in there? And one interesting one was for a depression medication was, why do people drop out of the study? In depression medication, it's about a 33% dropout rate, which is enormously expensive. And so they wanted to know, after 2 weeks, could we tell who's going to drop out? So that's the kind of uses that we'll get in data mining. Social networks. Anybody on Facebook here? Come on. Right, so... You know, the new privacy policy of Facebook is longer than the U.S. Constitution. Why is that? Because Google and Facebook are constantly changing their privacy policy because they want all of your data. They want to know everything about you. The invention of the cookie was probably the most brilliant invention ever, asking you not whether you want to opt in, but you're in. Whether you want to or not. Now, the only thing about that is they don't know that it's you. Specifically, all they know is your IP address, right? Wrong. Talk to the statisticians at Google. They have great algorithms to figure out that who in the household it is. They can figure out that the 50-year-old male in the household is going to these sites and not the sites where the 16-year-old female is going. They've somehow, some of the sites are the same, yes, but not all. With the pattern of that, they can figure out who's who, and they are learning more and more. It's not clear yet what they're going to do with all of this. The valuation of Facebook is still all over the map. $1 billion for that company 2 days ago. My son is in a little startup right now. That was very inspiring to him. You know, even his 1.5% of equity that he's going to get on $1 billion would be okay. You know, so I encouraged him. I said, hold out for $1 billion. But, yeah, we don't know where all of this is going yet. This is my favorite. So any chance to watch reruns of 24, I'll do all the time. And what I love is all the references to data mining. And what I love is the ability that they can do data mining. I mean, it's just great. I mean, Jack just calls up Chloe and says, can you just find out who this guy is? Data mine this in 10 seconds. And she's working away. He goes, come on, faster. And I just love that. I wish I could tell my students that. You know, just come on. You can't get this in 10 seconds. You can't figure out who this guy is, where he's going, what he's been doing in 10 seconds. What's wrong with you? As my son was watching it with me, he said, Dad, if they could really do this, there wouldn't be any crime in the U.S., would there? Good point. Right. So it's just great to listen to what 24 thinks about data mining. So, of course, it is happening. I mean, even the U.S. government is using data mining to do all sorts of things, as this gets evidenced in newspapers. And I'm thrilled that one of our sponsors today, anybody from the NSA here tonight? You guys never raise your hands. Doesn't matter. Anyway, I've had the really good fortune to be on a team at Stanford. So the NSA takes some of their hardest problems and they ship them to Berkeley, Stanford, and the University of Washington every summer. Now, I went to school in the 60s. I don't have clearance. I'm never going to get clearance. It's okay. But they clean them up so that we don't have the details about why they want to know this. So instead of telling us exactly what they want to do, they'll say things like this. They'll come in and they'll say, we have a very large database full of millions of rows and thousands of columns. I said, okay. And a very small percentage of these rows are really important for us to identify. We're going to label them with ones. Most people are zeros. They're okay. But we really want to find the ones. And when you develop an algorithm to do this, keep two things in mind. Don't mix up any zeros with the ones. That really wastes our time. And more important, don't miss any of the ones. So we're statisticians are thinking about this going, okay, we just got to develop an algorithm with bad data, lots of it, messy, and just no type 1 or type 2 error. Fine. Well, we'll have that for you next week. So we're still working on that. So the no mistakes is nice. There have been some great problems, and they have inspired some really wonderful research. And one of the things they do, I don't know if you know about Stanford and Berkeley, there's a little rivalry that goes on in the Bay Area and in the stat departments as well. So I'll get to that in one second. But so one of the problems they came to us is, here's another one I like. They said, we get about 500,000 documents a day in our computers in 147 languages. We can't read them all, nor can we even store them all. So in real time, we want you to develop an algorithm that tells us what are the 1% most interesting documents. We're working on that one, too. But one day, they came along and they said, before we get to that, we don't have no idea why the NSA would be interested in the following problem. It's a big network. And they say, we're interested in a network of people and when there might be changes in that network, where suddenly a lot of activity is happening between different nodes, and that might be interesting. Well, really? I wonder why. Yeah, anyway, so they're problems like that. But they're great problems. And one day they came to us and they said, to the Stanford group, they said, remember problem 13 from last year? And we went, yeah, that was hard. He said, well, Leo Bryman at Berkeley really came in with a good solution to that. It's like, just to give it to us. And we'll talk about that solution. That'll come up in a little bit. That was a great solution. Okay, so what I thought I'd do is show I want to get down a little bit into the details, and I'll show one of my favorite examples. It's one of my favorites because, one is, this was not a consulting problem. This was actually used for a competition in 1998. We're still working on it. It's a really hard problem. It's a problem that resonates with many, many companies. This happens to be the PVA, the Paralyzed Veterans of America, which is a philanthropic organization. And I'm just guessing, looking around the room, many of you are on their mailing list. If you are, you get address labels or greeting cards mailed to you about every 6 weeks with a little note that's saying, wouldn't you like to give to the Paralyzed Veterans of America? Now, everybody else has picked up on this idea about the address labels. Do you guys get tons of address labels every week? I mean, my drawer. And I don't even write letters anymore. Does anybody write letters? I mean, haven't they figured out we're not writing letters? You know, I've been at the same address now for 10 years. I must have 3 centuries worth of address labels. They're lovely, but anyway, that's a whole other issue. So just this problem was just the following. So they send these every 6 weeks. And the question is there a better strategy than just sending these address labels, which cost about, at the time, 67 cents to make and to mail out? Probably a little more expensive now, but, you know, times several million, that's a lot of money. Is there a better strategy than just sending it to everybody every time? Or could we learn the patterns? Is it better to send to people who didn't give last time? Is it better to send to the people who did give? What are the patterns? So they gave us data to use for this. 200,000 donors. 100,000 of them, we have all sorts of demographic and historical information, and then we know from their last campaign how much they gave, whether they gave, and how much they gave. We have the answers to build our model on. And then another 100,000 called the test set, where we're going to predict. Now, usually when we do data mining, we do this ourselves. We cut the data in half, and we play games with ourselves to see how well we can predict, pretending we don't know the answer. In this case, we really didn't know the answer. I do this to my students. They hate that, but that's my job. So that, the amazing thing is, oh, this is a little typo. There weren't 481 demographic variables. That's ridiculous. There were only 479 demographic variables. The other two were, did you give and how much you gave. So the 479 pieces of information on everybody in their database. 479 pieces of information on you. Think about that. Now, a lot of it is completely irrelevant. They buy it from the census. It's on the zip code, on your zip code level, median income of your zip code, percentage that go to college. I mean, you name it. They've got it. Some of it is their own data on your history of your giving. Some of it you've provided by happily filling out things on the web, and you say, oh, they want to know about me. Everybody loves to be understood. Isn't it great? We just say, oh, yeah, I'll just tell you everything about me, and then they buy it from other people. So they've got lots of information, and that's the question. So let's just look at this. What's hard about this? Well, there it is. There's the data. Now, if I could do this interactively, I could slide along, and you could see 479 columns like this. Wouldn't that be fun? You might notice, even from this, you see these blanks, these holes in the data? That's a problem. A lot of it's missing. Some of it isn't missing, but it's just because you didn't check it. So some of it really is missing, and some of it just means no. So they might say here, do you get this gardening magazine? Click here if yes. So no, blank isn't missing, it's no. And then there's this one. That this is just shows, some of these are, I love this. Child 03, child 07, child 12, and child 18. The following four questions were asked. Is there a child between the ages of 0 and 3 in your house? And the correct, only accepted responses are male, female, both, or blank. I have neighbors with triplets. What are they going to do? I don't know what they did. But so we have child 03, child 7, child 12, child 18. So I spent a little time converting that into one variable, which was number of children in the house, right? And I, you know, it wasn't too hard, but it takes time. You have to do that. I counted B as 2, and M or F as 1, and blank is 0. And so I got number of children. Then I noticed farther over in the data set, they had asked that as well. How many children do you have? Well, that was interesting because they don't match. Now, some of it I understand because it was how many children do you have at home? Okay, that's fine. So they could have more children than you have at home. But how do some people have more children at home than they have? That was confusing to me. And sometimes it just didn't match at all. So that's some of the wonders of data. It's all perfect. It's all there. It's wonderful. Not, as we say. So let's look at this. This is age. So I just thought I'd throw this up as a little exercise. So any volunteers to tell me, what do you see about this group? Anything interesting in this? This is a histogram of the ages. The bin size is wrong. Thank you. Okay, that's adjustable. I don't know if it's wrong is the right answer, but maybe inappropriate, perhaps. Okay, maybe a better... It could be bimodal. Okay, that's... It could be. It's got some weird... It alternates strangely. There's some funny rounding going on. But come on, guys, something simple. You guys are too math-oriented. What do my students say, first off, about this group? They're old, thank you. Yeah, their average age is near 60. Do you notice anything? Now, this box plot on the top with some very strange outliers on the left. There's some quite precocious, quite generous. So I went back here and did a little digging and tell you why did that happen? And it turns out that data that age is not asked for. It's derived from date of birth. So these were perhaps people who said they were born in 07 or 08 or 09. It's a little Y2K issue. They may no longer be with us, but they're in the database, and they're now counted as being 3. Kind of a rejuvenation effect. Right. So that could be that could explain some of it. But, you know, we can do summary statistics, et cetera. So, you know, this isn't a bad histogram to show. I know some of you teach stats. This is a nice one to ask the students to look at. It's got some weird features and some outliers. And we could clean that up, but with 70,000, taking out those few dozen outliers isn't going to affect things that much. Let's go to another variable. It's a variable called T-code. Now, I wouldn't suggest using this histogram for the first example of a histogram on day one. It's an odd one. There are some values along here. The max is 70,002. The min is 0. It's also not a good one to talk about summary statistics, particularly. The median is 1, which corresponds to a mean of 54. The interquartile range, the difference between the first and third quartiles, is 2, which usually corresponds to the standard deviation. That's 957. So I'm presenting this. Now, I've got, you know, a great class at Williams. I've got some really math-talented kids. And a couple hands will shoot up. One kid said, well, Professor, I looked at the book last night, and I noticed that we have a highly right-skewed distribution, so I would suggest taking a logarithmic transformation of these data. I said, well, hold that. Holster that idea for a minute. And I look over at the other side. I have my liberal arts majors over there, and they're all going, the whatever. And so I do that, and I entertain that idea. It doesn't really help. And then finally, one of the guys over here wakes up. I think it's near the drop ad period. They say, oh, what the heck? Let me ask a dumb question. I know, Professor, this is a dumb question, but what is this variable? And I say, thank you. That's the first intelligent comment anyone's made tonight. What is that? And so we look up what this is, and it turns out this is the code for the title that they put in front of your name on the on the address. So there's the 72,002. It's an odd system. So 1 is Mr., 2 is Mrs., so 1,002 is Mr. and Mrs. 00 is and. So this is Reverend and Mrs. So the average is 54. In case I didn't make these up. These are real. Your imperial, my suggestion as a consultant would be, if they use this for everybody, donations would really go up. I mean, if I get a letter saying, Your Imperial Majesty, might you have $5? I'm feeling a little more flesh. So the question is, we're all laughing, but is this variable important for knowing how much somebody's going to give or whether they're going to give? That's what I love. It's like, right, that's the problem. We have 479 variables like this. We've been through 2. We have, 6 hours? Yeah, we're good. Okay. So that's some of the challenges of that. We've just seen some of the challenges is that we have to decide whether this variable is categorical or quantitative. And if it's numbers, the computer software is going to assume it's numbers, that it's quantitative. It's going to take means. It's not going to say, oh, but those are categories. Now, if it says 1QR or something like that, it will say, okay, that's not a number. I get that. But if it's a number, it'll just assume it's quantitative. So we have that. Merging sources. I see Herb over there, and I'm just reminded of a time when Herb and I were consulting for a large bank that had just bought an insurance company. And everybody in the place was salivating about the cross-selling opportunities of this. And everybody was salivating except the IT group, who were sitting over here shaking and trembling at the idea of merging these two databases, how much work that was going to be. We watched this company for about 6 or 7 years, and finally were bought by somebody else, in the cannibalization of banks. And we'd ask them, well, how did that merging go? And they said, we're still working on it. Really hard. And data quality. We've already seen a little bit about data quality. Here's my favorite cartoon on that. It's Calvin saying, I'm filling out a reader survey for Chewing magazine. Hobbes is watching. He says, see, they asked me how much money I spend on gum every week, so I put $500. For my age, I put 43. And when they asked me what my favorite flavor is, I said garlic curry. Hobbes says, this magazine should have some amusing ads soon. And Calvin just says, I love messing with data. So that's the explanation. That's why it's so bad. Calvin's living in there. So the only one here I'm going to talk about, because we're getting a little short of time, is this is true. You think I made this up, but we're going to talk about missing values, why they're important. I used to teach at the Wharton School, and I taught a class for PhD marketers. Anybody in marketing here? Janet, sorry. So I gave a project. So one of the guys said, Al, I'm really interested in surveying. He said, I want to design an instrument to see how people feel about filling out surveys. I said, okay, see how that goes. And so he came back to me about 3 weeks later. I said, how did that go? He said, oh, it's amazing. I said, what'd you find out? He said, most people feel really good about filling out surveys. I said, did you get them all back? He said, no, only about 10%. Is that a problem? So some of what we do, we're going to get to modeling in a minute, but some of what we do is just graphics. This is my favorite graphic story, I think. I don't know if you've seen this. This is a picture of water consumption on 2 days in Edmonton, Canada. So the green one is a, quote, normal day. And then the next day, an event happened called the Olympic gold medal hockey game. And this is from noon to 6 p.m. So we go along here. This is water consumption. Again, remember, we go along here, and there's something called face-off. And suddenly, water consumption drops. I don't know, plants didn't need water or something. And that happens until something called end of first period, where suddenly there's a need for water again. And then it drops off, end of second period. I love this. No one is moving. End of third period. Apparently, this was a close game. Canada wins. Medal ceremony, and then you can almost hear what's happening there. So sometimes the graphic just tells the whole story. So I have to talk about the Titanic this week. Of course, they left yesterday, last night from Southampton, 100 years ago yesterday. Everything's looking good so far. They're on our way, so it's a good thing I'm not on the 14th. So I give these data to my students, and this is the crosstabs of survival by ticket class. So I give them, so the data are ticket class, male or female, and child or adult. That's the data we have. It's not great data. There's some argument about how good the data are. But anyway, we get that, and I ask them to explain to me what happened. So what I get is lots of things like this, lots of pie charts. More pie charts than I've seen since Ross Perot. He did more for the pie chart in 3 months than anybody else. But anyway, you know, when they say, well, this is different and this is different, what I get is a lot of facts. So I say, isn't there something we could do that really tells the story better? Well, here's a nice graph. This is called a mosaic plot. What a mosaic plot does, we've got four dimensions on here. The rectangles are proportional to the number of people in those rectangles. What are we seeing? On the left is the non-survivors. These are the survivors. So immediately you see it's about 3 to 1. There were 710 survivors, about 3 times that non-survivors. Within that, we have the male-female split. So the survivors were about 50-50. The non-survivors were not. Within that, we have ticket class distribution. And down here, we have the children separately. So that gets at some of it, but it's still not the easiest graph to read. But it can be a useful graph. So I'm going to tell you a little personal story here. I have 4 children. I have a big Verizon plan. At least I thought I did. Until I was away in sabbatical in France, and my daughter was a freshman at Wesleyan, and I got my bill in France, and it was $400. And normally I pay $149. It was $400. And I immediately, you know, I go, what now? And I look at it, and it says data charges, $279. And I thought, oh, well, maybe she's taking a stat course. And then that lasted about 3 nanoseconds until I realized what data charges meant. So I went in to the, and you could go online. And then there was a little button that said, I found out it was her, and then it said download. And I said, oh, yeah. There's seats up here if you guys want to come up. You don't want to stand the whole time. So I downloaded it, and I put it into this program. And so I called Cyrene, and I said, "What, Cyrene, what's going on here with this?" There were 6,000 text messages in 5 weeks, which I thought was a healthy number. And this is by day. And she said, well, Dad, you know, you guys were in France, and I didn't know a lot of people, so at the beginning I was really texting a lot, but it's really calmed down since then. So let's use this as a hypothesis test. You guys can help me out here. It's really calmed down is the hypothesis. Now, what these are is it's proportional, the width is proportional to the number of messages, and these distributions are the actual numbers, which I've taken off to protect the guilty. So I actually have, you can get this from Verizon. You get the numbers that she texted and how many. You don't get the message. That's TMI, as they say. But I get the time of day, and the number, and the number. So I put it here. So really calm down means there should be a whole bunch of fat ones over here, and it's just getting thinner and thinner and thinner as we get to the right. I didn't think so either. Okay, so then I said, okay, well, that's not happening. I said, well, what else can I learn? Let's do it by hour of the day. Now, I did something. It was 0 to 24, and I reordered it. You can't see this. I have to help you through it. I reordered it so the last ones are 0, 1, 2, and then 3 through 9 are over here. So you see, 3 through 9 is this little tiny, nothing happens from 3 to 9 in Middletown, Connecticut. Apparently, the sun rises about 9:45. The thumbs start to go into work, but by 11, they are really in full gear. 12, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I call her, I said, what do you do at 5? She goes, why, Dad? I said, what do you do at 5? She says, I usually go to the gym. Why? I said, very interesting. So I said, when do you have class? She said, 11, 12, 1. I said, and when do you study? She said, 9, 10, 11. I thought, okay. And then 0, 1, 2, boom, dropped off. And then I see there's some people she only texts at night. I said, whoa, wait a minute. This is too much information again. But I was trying to scare the living daylights out of her. That was the whole idea about this. So I sent it to her, and I said, look, this is what I get. So I get nothing back from her. And about 2 weeks later, she said, that thing you sent me, that stats thing? I said, you mean the mosaic plot? She said, yeah, is that just random kids for your book? I said, no, that's you. And she said, oh, how cool is that? Then I go to Parents' Day, and I meet all her friends. I meet Brooke, and I meet Jill, and I meet Taryn, and they all come up to me, oh, Mr. DeVoe, oh, so nice to meet you. You know that cool thing you sent Cyrene? I said, the mosaic plot? They said, yeah, I'm the lime green. I'm the magenta. I'm the... This totally didn't work at all. They were not... But anyway, the mosaic plot. So how can we get better? So I'm going to show you one of the first models of data mining. This is a decision tree. Now, this tells a story. The decision tree, I don't think we have time to go into the details, but the decision tree tells what's going on. So what it says is the most important thing to know about the person is, are they male or female? If female, what's the next most important thing? Ticket class. And it puts first, second, and crew together. That's survival rate. And third class over here. If you're a guy, it's not ticket class. It's whether you were a man or a boy. And then if a boy, it splits off, there were no crew, it splits off first and second from third. And for men, it splits off second and third from first or crew. There were a lot of crew who survived because they had to be in the boats. Right. And there's the first class. So tells the story. It's a beautiful, it works really simply. It just goes through each variable and tries to find out which variable and how I should split it to get the best separation. And there are lots of different criteria you could use. That's a whole 3-day course you could take. But that's basically the idea. Great little model. So here's how it works on the paralyzed veterans data that I showed you. So it starts off as a little different. We have a, by the way, there's only about a 5% response rate. Yeah. And that's a loyal group. Like these days, so banks no longer call it percent. They no longer measure things in percents. They use basis points just to make things sound better. Say, oh, yeah, that was a great campaign. We got 50 basis points on that. Back in the old days in the 80s, 5 or 6% was good, but nobody's responding anymore. So they get 5%, and you can see that's the blue. So we're identifying variables that help split off the high probability responders from the low. And it works pretty well. It's not a very sophisticated model. Here's, we started with the 5%. And the tree looks like this, and it splits on all sorts of variables. And what's nice about a tree is it explains the variables. And doctors especially love trees because it's a diagnostic. It's an expert system kind of thing. Oh, it's just the way I think. If under 30 and if this, then you. So that's great. But, you know, they're not terribly powerful models. They're pretty simple, but they're great for explanation. They're always the first thing I do in data mining, just to see what happens. So how well do they work? Sometimes they work great. This is actually a case from the hospital the ER was based on in Cook County. So what's the problem? You're trying to predict. So it's a triage problem, right? You get somebody with chest pains presenting themselves, and you have to say, am I giving them the resources of the hospital, or am I sending them home? And the doctors are conservative. So they're going to say, I don't know, you know, I don't want to send anybody home who's about to have a heart attack. So they have 75% type 1 error, false positives and 11% false negatives. And they're basing it's a hard decision. This was actually from Malcolm Gladwell's book, Blink, where part of the point is how difficult it is to make overwhelming decisions in the face of lots of data. So this is how well they did. Well, they put the same data through a tree, and I love the first variable. So on the electrocardiogram, did they have a suspected heart attack? If yes, high risk. I would say, that makes sense to me. I like that. That's, you know, that's called face validity in social science. Makes sense. If not, did they have this? And then they split it into four risk groups. And then the basis of that, they would take the high and the moderate ones and say, give them the ER. And the other ones, they might say, take two of these and call me on Monday. How well did that do? A little better. And this is in JAMA. So this was presented in the Journal of the American Medical Association. And apparently, it's not to replace the doctor's decision, but it's to help in these times of stress. Use this as a guide and reevaluate what you're thinking and see whether that helps. Apparently, it does. We can all use some data-driven decision-making as well as our own gut feeling. Okay, sometimes one of the new things in data mining is taking lots of models together. So we make a tree, but instead of that, we fit lots of trees to the same data. And we do that by essentially shaking up the data. We'll resample from the same data, get a slightly different tree, and then fit whole bunches of trees, and then average over all of those. That's called bagging, bootstrap aggregation. And then Leo Bryan, remember that great solution to problem 13? Leo Bryman's great solution to that was when you do this, when you shake the data, get another version of the data, and fit a tree again, you don't get a different enough tree. It doesn't really add enough, especially if you've got some powerful predictors. You're going to get those same predictors coming up first every time. So he said, here's an idea. Let's make the trees dumb. Let's take a small random set of predictors each time, every time we split, only let a few play. That way, if you've got a variable that's slightly hidden, it'll come out a bunch of the times. That idea, combined with the other, is called random forests. And the only image I could find was that. So there's that's a random forest. I put random forest in. That's what I got. So what do you get? You get, for the paralyzed veterans data, what you get is you don't get a model. You get hundreds of trees. So you can't really show the model, but you can show how important the variables are. And you typically get this long list of variables. They're all important in some sense. But what you want to do is zero in on the top ones. And the amazing thing about this was these were all the variables that make sense in terms of marketing. These are what's called recency, frequency, and amount variables. And when did you get your last gift? And when did you get a card gift with that? And what's the maximum amount you've ever given? All these sensible things. There was nothing about how many dogs do you have? Do you get this gardening magazine? They're all sensible economic variables. Using models like this, several people did pretty well. This is what gets people's attention. They increased, so I didn't tell you, the baseline, if you just send to everybody, you get $10,500 back in profit on 100,000 people. They only do in efficiency ratings. That's why they sent their data in. That's about here. These people got 14,000 back, so they increased it by about 40%. But the trouble is, that's not really that great compared to what you could have gotten if you just mailed to the right 5,000 people. If you just knew that. And why can't we do that? What question would you want to ask people the night before you're going to send them the address labels? Are you going to give? What do you think most people would say? No. Everybody would say, no, I'm not going to give. Don't bother. And then what happens? Something random happens. You open it up, and most of the time you just throw it away. But once in a while you go, oh, what the heck? I mean, you know, maybe it was like today. The Dow went up 90 points. You go, okay, sure, I got $5. It's random. That's the problem. A couple stories about what can go wrong here. How much time do I have? 10 minutes. Okay. I'm going to skip this one. No, I'm not going to skip this one. I like this one. So this is a problem I worked on about making ingots. That's an ingot. But these ingots that I worked on were 30,000-pound pieces of aluminum. 30,000-pound pieces of aluminum. Now, and they made a lot of this particular company. You can probably guess what company it is. They make foil as well. They're in Pittsburgh. Anyway, all right, so I was looking at that, and they had lots of data. They had 20 years' worth of data, and the problem was that on some of these ingots, so who would buy a 30,000-pound piece of aluminum? Too big. So hint, I've given this talk in Seattle and Toulouse, and they immediately, everybody goes, oh yeah, of course. It's Boeing and Airbus that want to buy these. And they want them to have no visible cracks on the surface because they want to roll these out into airplanes. The trouble is, about 25% of them had cracks. And so what they had to do is take this piece of aluminum and go, oh man, cracks. They didn't just throw it away, but they took it, carted it to the front of the line, recast it, redid it again, $30,000 to do that. So there was some opportunity here. So it took 8 months to get all this data. But now the two statisticians, me and my friend Brad, were ready to go. We pushed the button for the tree. After, this is 8 months of preparation. We pushed the button, and look what we got. So out of 23.5%, we got a split. 3,000 of them cracked 15.9%. 930 cracked 48%. Now, we were told that if we could get this cracking down to near 15%, we would save $6 million a year. So there's some incentive. I mean, we didn't get the $6 million, but the company would get that. So we thought, we are ready to go. Now, we did this. I happened to be on sabbatical in France, so we had to wait 6 hours for Iowa to wake up. And we're just like so excited. We're going to say, we've got it. We've got it. This is it. It's the alloy. So we called up, and I got the guy in Iowa, and I said, we got it. It's the alloy. And I'm waiting for the bands to play and the fireworks and everything. And after about 30 seconds, he says, yes, we know some alloys crack. That's why we gave you the data. We said, oh. So we can't use alloy. They know that these are the three alloys that crack a lot. What they want to know is why do they crack? So, all right, so we took alloy out and pushed the button again. But we didn't make it seem that simple. We waited several hours, make it seem like we were doing some work, and we did that. I changed this because otherwise I'd have to use a little camera. But it was some element, and we found that at this split, we got almost the same split. And this is some element being present or not. The high magnesium ones seem to be a problem. So we called them up and said, it's magnesium. He said, those are the high magnesium alloys. So at this point, we're really discouraged. And we thought, oh man, now we actually have to understand something about this. So we spent a few days and talked to the chemists again. And why are we so stupid is because this project, you can't learn everything about the science. And we were trying to understand as much as we could. They gave us all these data. We thought they were fine. So the third time, we got chromium. And so now we're really scared. It looks like chrome, but I'm... You know, I didn't say, it's chrome. I said, it looks like it could be chromium this time. And I didn't get this. This is what I'm hoping for. That never happens, in fact. It never happens. What you get is, huh, that's funny. That's a big success. So Isaac Asimov says, this is how science progresses, not with eurekas, but by, huh, I wonder what's going on. So they thought about that. 6 months of experimental designs, small changes, et cetera, they got the cracking rate down to 15% starting with these hints. So we were good to go. Okay. I am going to skip some of this. Let me just ask you a question. So one of the big things in data mining is associations. What's associated with what? So here's a question. What's the most highly associated item with shampoo purchases in a grocery store? Good guess. Wrong. So, another good guess. Milk. Yes, milk. It's highly associated with everything. Right, that's a problem. This is called what LexisNexis called a noise word. It's like, you know, you don't search on the. Google figured that out a while ago. You know, the and of are not good matching words. You want to strip those out. So that makes it challenging. All right, so what else can go wrong? So this is the problem with associations. Dogbert says, you need to do data mining to uncover hidden sales trends. If you mine the data hard enough, you can also find messages from God. sales to left-handed squirrels are up. And God says, that tie doesn't go with that shirt. What is this about? Associations can tell you all sorts of silly things. You may have heard of beer and diapers, the famous beer and diapers story. They were found to go together. My question is, who cares? What are you going to do with that? Even if they did go together, which wasn't really demonstrable, but if they did go together, what are you going to do? Put the coupons for the diapers on the beer? Really? I'm a little confused by that. Then we have this explanation from a company in England. Now, I was confused by this. This is an English company. It says, at 6:32 every Wednesday, Owen Bly buys nappies and bitter. Okay, so I got that nappies were diapers and bitter was beer. This is the English version. But I didn't understand why Friday was Wednesday. Anybody know why? So I gave this in London. I said, yeah, what's up with this? And everybody says, well, football. It's the big football night. So that's the answer. So that's the answer for beer and diapers. My question is, does this make you want to buy expensive software? I don't think so. Then I saw this recently. I don't know if you heard this. This is big news. So I've got just a couple minutes left. It's the end of science. The scientific method is outdated because now we have data. So we don't need that. This was Chris Anderson editorial in Wired magazine, the end of science. And I get this. My son is a computer scientist, so that's why we have Wired in the house. And there's just steam coming out of my ears as I'm reading this. And he's saying, Dad, chill. You know, what's up? And I said, this is crazy. And he says, the end of theory. We don't need theory anymore. We just need data. And I said, well, we have lots of data. Did you know that short men are at great risk for heart attacks? It's true. We have lots of data to show this. So I ask high school, I loved asking high school students why this is. I love the answers I get. So one student said, well, actually it should be the other way because for tall guys, the heart's really far from the brain. So it's a long way, and shouldn't it be the other way around? And then some other kid said, well, they're stressed out because they're short. And I said, well, actually, there's an even easier explanation for that. I give this class to two very different groups. I give it to my 18-year-olds. I give it to my lifelong learning class. Who's taller? And guess what? The shorter guys, on average, are at greater risk for heart attacks because they're 80. That's the big variable. Without a model, we can't see that. Then Hunch is a little magazine data collection agency that was written up in Wired, found this. I said, did you know the following? People who eat fresh fruit every day are more likely to buy pricey digital cameras. Okay. People who swat flies like USA Today, who swat rather than push away, I guess is the swatters like USA Today. I didn't make these up. I couldn't have made these up. People who cut sandwiches diagonally prefer Ray-Bans. Aren't these useful? And finally, people who believe in alien abductions prefer Pepsi to Coke. I thought, this is the four best things they found out from 55 million questions. All right. So very quickly, I'm going to end with two very quick success stories. I'm going to end with one very quick success story. I worked for the company for a while. I can say it's been long enough now. It was Hewlett-Packard. And they never sent their printer to the moon, but I love this picture. What they did, they had something called the backpack printer, which environmentalists took out into rugged terrain. And it was a battery-operated inkjet printer for doing environmental sampling. You see them now in taxi cabs and at restaurants and other places. But at the time, it was a big thing, and it was battery-operated. It wasn't for students to race to class and, you know, be printing out as they flew around to class. It was for environmental sampling. But the problem was that we had too many warranties coming in. The rate of warranties was just too high. So they said, what's going on? Well, there wasn't a lot of data. People don't tell what happened. They just give you their zip code. They give you maybe their demographics. We put this through something called a neural network. All I'm going to say is it looks like that. And I know this has been a little equation light for some of you people, so I'm going to give you the equation of a neural network just so you feel like you can take something home. You take that home. Okay, so that's the equation. So it's a little function fitter is what it is. Anyway, it's a black box. You don't typically get a lot of information out of it. What we found out was zip code was the most important variable. Yeah, that's the way we felt. It's like, okay, so don't sell it there. seemed like a good solution. Then my brilliant colleague said, let's throw these up on a map. Here are the problem zip codes. My first question was, do you sell it anywhere else? They said, yeah, we sell this all over the place. They're environmental sampling. But that seems to be the problem. So now we got together, the chemists, the engineers, everybody said, what do you think it is? Somebody says, elevation. I looked at the chemists. You're going to be the chemists here. I said, elevation. They go, nah, that's not a problem. Any other ideas? Water damage. What kind of water damage? Low humidity. I said low humidity. I watched three chemists in the front go. It had been developed here and tested there. And when they opened it up and did a few experiments and changed the viscosity a little bit and opened up the nozzle a little bit more, saw dust particles, saw the viscosity was drying out a little, problem was fixed in 2 weeks. That was it, low humidity. So is that a success for data mining? I'd say yes. I mean, what's great is that data mining is never automatic. It involves thinking. Amazing. The more you know, the better you're going to do it. My students, I have to brag about my students. So they are the winners of the cup. Last year, this is how my top three students did. She just finished her PhD at Harvard, and she's teaching at Duke. So that's a success. She did pretty well on that. She would have won. You can do well. So my bottom line here is that good data plus knowing something plus data mining plus thinking equals success, not any one of those by itself. Sorry I went over, but thank you.